Hello and welcome to the third episode of the second series of the Old Songs podcast, brought to you by Tradfolk in conjunction with the English Folk Dance and Song Society. So this is an odd one. As some of you may know, my dear friend and neighbour Paul Sarton passed away very suddenly last week, and he passed away in between the recording of this episode and the editing of this episode. And the thing is, this episode is about The Brisk Lad, which is a song that Paul was very connected with. We'll see how he was connected with it later on in this interview with Jimmy Aldridge and Sid Goldsmith. But I thought long and hard about whether to actually put it out, because there is this section in this interview about Paul, and it wasn't terribly easy to edit, I'll be honest. But Paul was passionate about traditional songs, and Paul was passionate about this song, and he felt a deep connection to it. And it's something that he sang in the folk club that we ran together relatively recently with his son Joe. So I thought I'd go ahead with it. And besides, it would be unfair for Jimmy and Sid not to get to enthuse about it themselves. So let's say it's a tribute to Paul, shall we, this episode. I'm sure Jimmy and Sid wouldn't mind me saying that. And we'll get on with it as best we can. We're talking about The Brisk Lad, which is Roud 1667. And we've got loads to talk about. We've got to talk about where it came from. We've got to talk about who sang it. We've got to talk about who sang it to who. We've got to talk about who's sang it since. And we've got to talk about why Jimmy and Sid feel a particular connection themselves to this song. And we're also going to talk a little bit about Jimmy and Sid's amazing sing-around sessions that they run in Bristol. So I'm not going to rabbit on any further, but I am going to say that this first version that you're about to hear is Paul Sarton singing the song with Faustus. So sit comfortably and drink it in.
I am a brisk lad, but my fortune is bad. And I am most wonderful poor. Oh, indeed, I intend my life for to mend, and to build a house down on the moor, my brave boys. And to build a house down on the moor.
Hello, Jimmy and Sid.
Hello.
Hiya, John.
Thanks for being on the Old Songs podcast.
Oh, it's about time, isn't it? We've been threatening to do this for so long.
Hanging around outside the door for ages.
Yeah. Scratching at the door.
Desperate to get in. And here you are. And in your 10th year as well.
Yeah. We're going on our 10-year anniversary tour soon. How exciting.
When do you kick off?
We've got Bristol on Friday, which is a bit of an outlier. And then the rest of the dates are in a couple of weeks' time.
Start of October, aren't they?
Yeah, so we're out from the 2nd to the 6th of October.
Excellent. And you're going to be down there at Cecil Sharp House, the home of all these songs, on the 5th, I believe, at 7:30 p.m.
Looking forward to playing there. We've done it once before, haven't we? But that was with Awake Arise, the winter show that we do with Lady Maisie.
Yeah, and once as a duo.
We did it downstairs, didn't we? That's right. Yeah.
Are you upstairs this time?
No, I do. Sure. I think it depends how many tickets we've sold. Buy your tickets, exactly. It's just such an amazing place to go and play music. I mean, so much history there. So it's a delight to be asked back. And it's one of those gigs that's been on the radar for a long time, but got pushed back once or twice because of the pandemic. So yeah, it feels good to sort of finally get out and have a little tour and for Cecil Sharp House to be in the middle of that's great.
Have you spent much time there? Have you ever done any sort of digging around in the library?
I've spent a couple of hours in the library once. But no, I haven't, to be honest. I spent quite a bit of time in Horsey Manor Library a few years back, And after that, I was all juiced up, and I thought I'll get into Cecil Sharp and have some time there. But the opportunity's just never presented itself. But maybe someday.
It's great fun. If you can get them to take you down into the archives and have a look at the old notebooks, quite a thrill, I have to say.
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah.
Just get there a bit early. I'm sure they'll help you out.
Yeah,
I'm sure they'll sort you out, Sid.
It's a good idea.
So we're going to talk about the Brisk Lad or the Sheep Stealer, which is Raoud 1667. Am I correct?
You're correct, yes.
I have been wrong before. It's only got two titles from what I can make out, which is quite unusual for a folk song. Have you found any others?
Well, it's The Brisk Lad, The Sheep Stealer, and then All I Have Is My Own, although I actually couldn't find a version with that title, but I saw it written down somewhere. But yeah, mainly The Brisk Lad and The Sheep Stealer.
I did see one other. I've just said that there's only two, but I did see one other from the north of England, like a rare example of it being from the north of England, which was called, can't read my own writing now.
when is that from?
Like 1981. So it was collected, like a really recent collection.
Grangemore,
that's the very fellow. Before we go too far into all of that, I just want to start off with you two. And I would love to know a little bit about how each of you came to traditional music. Do you have folky backgrounds? Are you dyed-in-the-wool folkies? Are you latecomers? Did you grow up at festivals?
We are definitely latecomers, I think, both of us. We didn't learn folk songs at our grandmother's knee, unfortunately. I wish that had been the case. But I think we actually both came into traditional music from backgrounds playing sort of blues and traditional music from different parts of the world. I played a lot of rock music when I was growing up, through some of the sort of really big names, you know, Dylan, at the centre of all of that, started to just investigate, well, hold on, what is this traditional music that I'm hearing kind of, you know, in popular culture, and what does that mean? What's English traditional music? And have kind of come in that way, I guess, and gone deeper and deeper down as we have started to sing and play traditional music from lots of different parts of the world. But as we are English and we want to have, you know, integrity in the songs that we're choosing to sing, and for it to sort of represent as closely as we can the culture that we feel a part of, I guess we've gone further and further down into English traditional music. We're definitely not, I think you'd agree with this, like students of traditional music, in the way that I think some acts on the scene are much more rooted in the tradition, and that's where they start, and they might be songwriters too, but they've kind of started with a tradition. I think we've probably come at it the other way, and I don't know, maybe a third of our set is traditional, but a lot of what we've done over the last few years has been our own songwriting, or songs from the sort of folk canon that we wouldn't term as traditional, that were maybe written in the 60s 70s.
I saw you both a couple of weeks ago at Folk East, and we had that marvelous session in the Hop Inn.
We had a lovely time,
didn't we? And then the next, well, you and me had a lovely time, Sid, and Jimmy went home early, threw his toys out the pram and went home early. No, he didn't.
I honestly regret that for the rest of the weekend. I mean, you know, I did do the right, I had to get my daughter to bed, and I had kept her up and about at Folk East, so she's 15 months old, and she was about till, what was it, about 11:30 midnight, and I thought, you know, she's done well. But when John, you started singing one of your old songs, she got a bit upset, so I had to take her to bed. That's not true. She was enjoying it very much, and then it was time to go. But it sounds like it went on and on, that session. I was very sad to leave it.
And then there was a little bit of a reprise the following evening. But what I was going to say is, for a pair of people who claim to sort of, you know, only partially be traditional singers and that kind of thing, you have really quite expansive repertoires, don't you? I mean, certainly in the tunes with Sid, you seem to know everything.
I wouldn't make that claim, but. Yeah, I guess tune playing is I've been saying that it's new to me for way too long now. I think I've been playing the concertina for maybe 5-6 years, and that was really the start of my journey as a tune player. I definitely have been much more interested in the song traditions until that point, but yeah, I've spent a lot of time on that over the last little while.
Was your background much the same as Jimmy's in terms of
much
song?
The same, yeah. I guess not so much coming to folk through the sort of the pop folks, the Dylans and those things, although I did love Bob Dylan. It was more through exposure, because there was a folk club, the Milkmaid Folk Club, moved into my local boozer when I was 17 or 18. And I got a job doing sound because I happened to have a PA system that I was playing my electric guitar very loudly through. So I ended up doing the sound for Martin Carthy, loads of people as a very young... I might have almost fallen asleep to Martin Carthy before I realised how good it was. You know, I was at that point where I had my finger in my ear and then took it out to see that everything was still working. And then just through exposure, people like him and Vin Garbutt was a huge one. I couldn't believe this guy walking on stage and singing these songs in this complete like nasal voice, piercing, and then within a couple of choruses he just had me, and what he was singing about felt so pertinent and important, and I'd never witnessed that on a stage before. So yeah, I was converted by exposure, I would say.
Would it be fair to say that you're, for both of you, the sort of politics of the songs are quite important?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that was where Vin Garbutt really hit home, especially like the Chemical Workers song, which we've sung at pretty much every gig for the 10 years that we've been singing together. That like standing up for workers' rights message really stirred something in me, and then I started to look for those sort of songs, and it's definitely been a thread of what we look for in the duo. I think we found that's really good common ground for both of us, that we want to sing about the injustices and you know, make aware the plights and all of that stuff. We also want to sing about love and puppies and stuff, but you know.
Well, it's a good time to be singing about injustices, isn't it? You must have quite a lot of material to be writing about.
There's plenty of material to write about, and I guess over the years, you know, what we've tried to find are parallels with the experiences that we're having, that we're seeing in the modern world, represented in these old songs, and often they are, you know, the songs that are maintained within the tradition, that are passed down from singer to singer to singer, have some kind of truth, I guess, of what it is to be a normal person growing up and living in this country. And a lot of those themes remain, whether that was, you know, in the 1700s and you're pushed into poaching, or whether it's in sort of today's society and you're dealing with like massive cost of living crisis and what are you going to do? You know, a lot of the themes are kind of there. And I guess that is what we have tried to do in curating the songs that we do, you know, often naturally by just, we see a song, we love it, it comes into our set. What we're doing there, I guess, is finding those songs that says something about how we are viewing the world. And there is a rich old thread in this incredible canon of songs that we draw from the tradition that just does that so well. I think in English traditional music, it's not always really upfront. You know, it's not necessarily like a poaching song often will sound very celebratory. Be sort of jolly old, like, let's go and jump over some hedges and ditches and stiles and off we go, you know, and the moon's out and we're having a great time. But the symbols within that are representing, I think, these themes that are there right throughout our history.
And this is a quite a good example of it, isn't it? This song. Can you, one of you, give me a kind of rundown, a sort of rundown of the narrative of the song? What goes on in The Brisk Lad? Are we calling it The Brisk Lad or The Sheep Stealer?
Well, we call it The Brisk Lad, but we know it as both. I'll have a crack and Sid, correct me. But it's a song, in our interpretation, of desperation, where you have the voice of the song. He's pushed into a situation. He's very, very poor, and he's looking to fix that situation. And he's forced, basically, to go out and find sheep to steal, to bring back, butcher at home with the help of his children. And while that is going on, to stand on the porch of his house, on the, you know, on the step in his door, and wait for the police constables to come, and he will stand there with his gun and fight them off if they do come, and swear that everything he has is his own. And so it's, yeah, as I said, it's a, the narrative is one of kind of poverty and of desperation being pushed into a situation where he has to do something that, I guess he doesn't want to be in that situation, but there is nowhere else to turn.
I guess, like, on a really quick skim, you could be forgiven for thinking that it's bragging, that it's, you know, saying I'm going to go out and get myself a sheep. But then if you look into it, there's lines like, indeed, I intend my fortune to mend. It's showing the necessity. It's I'm in a bad position. I need to do this. And I think the empathy with the character is so strong. And then there's that wonderful line that Jimmy just spoke about. When the constables do come, I'll stand with my gun and I'll swear all I have is my own. Mm. And that defiance and the bravery of it is really inspiring. It's something that is really hard to do, to know that you're right when you're having to break the law to provide the things that you need to sustain yourself. We should all be able to see it and feel totally just in doing these things if we're brought to a point where it's necessary, but it's really hard to believe in yourself. So it's so nice to hear that, like, that belief and defiance in the song.
It reminds me of, in the song Geordie or Georgie, you have a similar sort of character in that, the woman who's going to try to save her husband from being hung in chains of gold, and she's sort of standing there and sort of, you know, defiantly sort of saying, what the hell's going on, basically, you know, like standing up to those holding her away from the man that she loves. They're great, those characters, aren't they?
Yeah, we need them. We need them.
Go into where it comes from and that kind of thing. Have you picked up anything? Do you know much about it?
I know what's on the Vaughan Williams Library. There's several collections around between 1905 to 1907. The first one that I've got is the George Dowden, and it's all Henry Hammond collected, apart from one by Lucy Broadwood, which is Edith Sutton. That's all that I've found really on collections. I didn't see your 1981 one.
I guess it's kind of unusual, isn't it? Other than the Grange Moor, which I wonder is a bit of an anomaly, it's kind of unusual in that you've got a song here that's collected. I think I only found two source singers that it was collected from, but I saw somewhere that it had been collected from four. Within the Hammond collection, there are four different versions, but I wasn't able to find all of those. But I guess it's unusual in that they are all from Dorset.
Yeah.
Within about 30 miles of each other, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's quite a popular song for modern singers, obviously, and it was recorded by a good many people. But on the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library archive, there are only about 20 entries held there. Although it was pointed out to me recently by the great man himself, Steve Roud, he dropped me a little line and said that the entries on the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library website only refer to those that they've so far managed to list. So there are many more maybe waiting in the wings, because, you know, it's really his lifetime's work, that man. He's done from what started in a shoebox, basically, has grown to take over his whole life. But unfortunately, that makes the entirety of the Old Songs podcasts up until this point so far entirely invalid. So if you're starting on this podcast series here, it's the only one you need so far, because all the rest of them are absolute gubbins.
Corrected by Steve Roud.
I was quite pleased to be corrected by him. I mean, he was very encouraging. He said some very nice things, and he was very keen to listen. But yeah, have to get it right. Absolutely. I do use his name a lot, so I can't be taking that name in vain. I think the interesting thing certainly is that it does seem to be quite sparse in the number of listings that they've got. You know, it's certainly not one of those songs that sort of spread all over the place. The listings only seem to have come from England. Dorset, as you say, apart from this one random outlier up north. And yeah, all within about 20 miles of each other, you'll find a good handful of versions of the Brisk Lad from Puddletown to Corscombe on that website, but no further really. And yeah, I also found a few of those. I think it's more than two, certainly. Like the ones that I picked up, much like you said, were between 1905 and 1907, collected by the Hammond brothers. In first of all, well, we've got Mrs. Stone of Dorchester, Joseph Taunton of Corscombe, George Dowden of Lackington, and then Mrs. Edith Sarton, also of Corscombe. Edith Sarton, as you say, was collected from by a number of different people. And actually, it's Edith Sarton that I'm going to focus in on a little bit because she's quite an interesting character. But certainly, yeah, it's not one of those ones that, according to that website, that have jumped across the sea and gone anywhere else. And of course, it's quite possible that it was much further spread. It's, you know, it's collected by the Hammond brothers. And it may have been collected by other people and not, you know, sort of filed, or it may be that nobody else bothered to collect it anywhere else or came across it anywhere else, but it doesn't mean to say that it didn't exist somewhere else.
Yeah, and then I've got that it was printed really shortly after in the Folk Songs from Dorset, the Henry Hammond collection, 1908. And it was the first song in that collection. So I think it was probably quite prized by them at the time.
Yeah, and even so now, I mean, it's certainly got more recordings of it in the 20th century than it was ever sung by source singers. Do you know much about Edith Sarton? Have you ever come across her before?
Come across her, yeah, but no, don't know very much at all, and would love to hear more. Really, I know you've sort of dug in a little bit because of the connection with Paul, but it'd be great to hear some of that.
Well, let me make your day, young Jimmy.
I'll sit back and get my cup of tea.
Yeah, no, I don't know terribly much about her, to be honest, but she is quite an important figure amongst source singers, the people that the songs were collected from. She was related to Marina Russell, who was born Marina or Mary Sarton. And Marina Russell we've come across in previous episodes of this podcast because she was a well of songs. Marina Russell offered up somewhere around 100 songs. Sometimes it's written that she's Edith and Marina were sisters. Other times it's not. So I'm not going to go one way or the other. She's just a relation as far as I'm concerned. But Marina Russell tended to have fragments. And I've said this before on this podcast, but it's a line that I do love, that when the Hammond brothers noted down some of her biographical background, which was very rare for them to do, they weren't very good at that side of things. All they really wrote about her was that she was extremely lacking in faculties and teeth. So she, which, you know, is kind, but she had a tendency, apparently, to sort of dance around the kitchen and sing these fragments of songs as they came to her. So quite a lot of the songs that we get from Marina Russell were fragmentary and sort of have to be filled out by other versions.
Well, a wonderful image that is, though, of her sort of skipping around, finding these little bits of songs without teeth. Nice. I love that.
And apparently she only sung in C or C sharp or something like that. Like she had this one key that she could deal with.
In English folk song journal that I found a little reference to her, which was they were not to know quite so many songs again from a single singer until they met the inexhaustible and infuriating Mrs. Marina Russell.
That's right, yeah, and I think what happened is that the Hammond brothers, who we'll come on to in a second, because I've not really dealt with them before, but the Hammond brothers, they met Edith Sarton originally, and she had about 11 songs, and they tended to be quite full. And what's quite interesting is that, according to the Hammond sort of diaries, she tended to deal in quite doomy and gloomy songs, and the Brisk Lad or the Sheep Stealer was actually one of her more positive numbers.
So, wow.
says something. I mean, actually, what it says quite a lot about, I think, is the nature of living in those rural areas at that time. Mm-hmm. That if these are the songs that sort of strike this woman as being worth singing and representative of her in some way, then life must have been pretty tough. Some of the other songs that Edith sang to the Hammond brothers were Sweet William, Lowlands of Holland, Lady Maisery, The Captain's Apprentice, and quite a number of other ones. She had a quality album within her.
Yeah, she did. Some great songs in there.
And the Hammonds, just to cover them off, because I think they're quite interesting to, you know, it's really important to talk about who sang these songs originally, but also quite interesting to know who was, you know, having the interest to go out and collect them. And the Hammonds were a pair of Somerset gentlemen who were persuaded to take up folk song collecting by Cecil Sharp, who asked them to go out and start collecting in Dorset. And Henry Hammond was quite a brilliant scholar. He was sent to Rhodesia at the age of 33 by the British government to run the Rhodesian education system at only 33. And he returned a year later in a state of broken health. So obviously more of a challenge than he thought. And so cycling out into the Dorset countryside to listen to sort of rural workers singing their songs rather appealed to him. And yeah, they met Edith in 1906, and she sang them these 11 rather gloomy songs. And actually, the person that I got most of this information from is a chap called Bonnie Sartin. Do you know of him? He was in a band called The Yetties, and he's a relation of Paul Sartin, my neighbour, of Bellowhead fame and Faustus fame, who is obviously also a relative of Edith Sartin and Marina Russell. And he's done a whole master's degree in Edith Sartin's songs alone. So he's a good person to try to catch up with if you want to find out some more. Actually, one of the most amazing renditions I've heard of The Brisk Lad is Paul singing it with his son, Joe, who is 18 years old. And when they introduce it, when they sing it, because they often sing it in our local pub, for example, and when they introduce it, they talk about it being, you know, an heirloom. Like it's, you know, some people will get sort of a watch, some people get, you know, an instrument, and in Paul's case he got these 11 songs, and they're the heirlooms of his family, so he sings them with his son in beautiful harmony.
It's incredible and slightly intimidating as well. You know, sometimes when you take on these songs, you're aware that they do have a real like family tie for lots of people, and you need to be very respectful, not just of like the tradition that they come from, but also the singers that have held on to them, and make sure, you know, if you're going to drop that line or you're even going to add in little bits here and there, you do it very, very sensitively. But what an amazing heirloom to have. I'm envious of that, to be passed down a song like that.
Yeah, well, I think he realized that quite late on as well. And as I said, he went off and did his master's degree in it, in her songs. Tell me about your relationship to the song. Like, do you remember when you first heard it, or whose version you might have first heard?
Yeah, I think for both of us it would have been Last Night's Fun. Chris Sherburn, Denny Bartley, Nick Scott. Their version is sung by Denny, who, do you know them at all?
I don't.
Denny has the most wonderfully impassioned Northern Irish voice. When he's singing, the urgency is so at the front of it that you just believe every word he says. And they sing this, and they pair it with an Irish reel called The Humours of Tully Crin, which is also an incredibly defiant tune. So the combination of those things is so powerful.
And did you hear it? Did you hear a recording of them, or did you hear it actually in the room?
Well, they're one of the bands that played at the Milkmaid, actually. They were the first band that came there on the opening weekend. So I'd heard it there, and then we did a gig with them, didn't we? When we're really early days of Jimmy and Sid, we went and did a wonderful concert, which was...
Hard Draw, wasn't it?
Yes, Hard Draw Force, the Green Dragon.
Yeah.
This amazing pub with a waterfall out the back. And there was a folk weekend there, and the evening concert was Granny's Attic, Us, and Last Night's Fun. And it ended in a giant music session with Mike Harding doing the duck walk to Johnny B. Goode with his mandolin. It was a fantastic evening. But we got hold of one of their CDs that weekend and had it in the van and just fell in love with their recorded version of it. And I remember there was a day where we'd gone to sort of retreat away to work on music, and we basically spent the whole, you know, we thought let's get some new material together, and I think we spent the whole 24 hours in this Airbnb just playing their version of The Brisk Lad, and then realising that it was too much like theirs, let's not do it. but we had a lovely old time.
I am a brisk lad whose fortune is bad, and I am misfortunate poor. Indeed, I intend my fortune to mend and to build a house down on the moor, me brave boys. To build a house down on the moor.
Just Denny's voice. I mean, if you haven't heard the version of it, I really, really recommend it. His voice is just so perfectly suited to the story itself. As Sid said, he just has this like urgency at the front of it. And so, yeah, we went and just did a sort of cover version of it for 24 hours. And then because it sort of didn't feel quite right, we hadn't got our own version, it sort of disappeared off for a while, but has popped back up in the last few months. And I think now we've kind of got our own arrangement of it, and I think it will be one of the things that we take forward into we'll definitely sing it on the tour that's coming up, but I suspect we'll record it at some point. It just feels like it's come round at the right time for us, and it's a song that kind of we want to sing. It sits very well with, I guess, our approach to traditional music and the types of songs that we choose. But yeah, there's loads of great versions out there. I mean, yeah, it's the same for me as Sid. I had that version first. But I mean, I think a lot of people will have heard Mike Watterson's version first, very well known and quite true, I think, to the version that was collected by the Hammond Brothers. And then the Voice Squad have done a version of it as well, which has gone fairly widely. And I did see in the liner notes to their version of it that I don't know if they heard it first from Vic Legg, great singer from the travelling community down in Cornwall. I don't know if they collected it from him or they were just chatting to him about it, but he was saying it has travelled very, very widely within the travelling community. And you can really see why. It is a song that, you know, feels like it could have been sung from a traveller's perspective, and it's got that kind of, yeah, that defiance in it that I think sits sort of quite well with the experience of many traveller communities living in this country to today.
I'm interested in how you've sort of brought it around to being your own version. Like, what does it take to feel comfortable with a song, do you think?
It's a good question, and it's a really difficult one to answer. And actually, I think, and so like you might have a different view on this, I think that is slightly changing for us, has changed over the last few years. Whereas when we first came together, we had songs that we'd picked up from sing-arounds, from records, you know, from a bit of digging. And we got the duo together and we were like, right, let's do an album. And we sort of chucked them all in the pot and then popped out. As you start to get further in and, you know, you need to go a bit deeper, you get a bit more selective about the songs that you're choosing. And certainly I guess, the last 10 years have really wanted to express my politics through my music, because that was something that was taking up a lot of my interest and my energy. And so the songs that we naturally gravitated towards were political songs. And as we arranged them, I guess that's part of what you're trying to project, is like, what is it that's in this song what's the message in this song that we can take from our history or this moment that the main character is experiencing, and how can we kind of reflect that into people's experience today. And so that's guided the arrangement is pulling out that message. But maybe it's like that we're softening. I mean, Sid's comfortably into his 40s now, and I'm not far off, that we are definitely starting to open to different songs. They don't have to represent our politics, although often those are the ones that we're drawn to. And I think you then naturally arrange things slightly differently. You're trying to communicate a different type of message. And so the way that we approach it, I think, has changed a little bit. Maybe we're just going to, getting softer and softer, and the arrangements are getting sweeter and sweeter. But I don't know, Sid, do you agree with that?
I'd agree with all that, yeah. I think I'd add to it, though, just that the songs live with you for a long time. What I mean by that is that, like, when I was first going and intentionally looking for songs in via, like, you know, all of the source singers' recordings that you can find online, and the Vaughan Williams Library, Memorial Library, and all these different places that you go to find them, I was very often flicking through books and going, Empire, no, gone. You know, Patriarchy, no, gone, not singing that. You know, and they were just, I was just flying through all these songs, and they were getting logged in my head somewhere, but they were just no's immediately. And occasionally you find something that just fits the bill, and you're like, great, that one. But even those ones that you've discounted, they live with you. You do take that set of lyrics around with you, and you're aware of that song. You're aware of its content, and the ones that you've okayed as well. You're living with those, and they'll be at the front of your mind. So they'll come into your mind more often, and you find what you like about them over time. For me, anyway, I find that there's so many that I've discounted in the past, but over the years, I've been like, oh, no, that line is really worth singing. What else is there in here that's worth digging into? So I think it's the fact that they're in your consciousness as you go about your life for so long, that then at some point it feels like I should really voice that now.
For it's I'll roam around on some other man's ground. I shall take a fat ewe from his pack, and with the aid of me knife, I shall shorten its life, and I'll carry him home on me back, me brave boys. I shall carry him home on me back.
One thing I was going to add is that over the last couple, two, three, four years, I think both of us have done a lot more singing in sessions. You know, we've talked to you about it before, but we've got a session that we set up in Bristol that we try and get to as much as we can now, although we're not able to as much as we used to. But used to go, you know, every month, and we drop in at singing sessions like all over the place, and we sing with our mates all of the time, and that's almost exclusively a cappella now. We very rarely turn up to a session with an instrument. That has brought out a different type of delivery and a different type of song, because, you know, okay, well, what am I going to bring this month? And so it's not like, what's the message and what are we going to record and what are we going to put in front of people on a stage? It's like, okay, like within that environment, what sort of song works? And so I think that sort of pulled a different type of delivery out of us, certainly, if not a different type of song.
It's a very interesting point, is that, you know, when we were, again, going back to the Folk East session that the three of us were at, it really works without instrumentation, isn't it? It's, I mean, that's what makes a traditional session sing around wonderful, in fact. It's like, as soon as the guitar comes out, it slightly spoils it.
It can do. It can be a barrier to communicating the song very often, yeah.
And it is interesting, isn't it, as you say, that you do have, you know, you create an album, you might have a theme, you might be looking at songs that sit within that theme. You might tour that album and, you know, for the course of that tour, you're singing these songs and you're in that particular mindset. And then you go into a session and you find that none of those songs actually fit. So you've almost got a repertoire of songs that fit, because in that session, you're either intending to bring people into the song, you want them, you know, a great sort of communal feeling. You might have a shanty in your back pocket that sort of gets everybody singing along sort of, you know, raucously. You might have a song that you know, you want to just hold everybody in the palm of your hand in that moment and sort of you know, feel that sort of emotion together. Or you might just have a song that you want to make everybody laugh with. And it's really interesting that you sort of start, I've started finding that I kind of have subsections of my repertoire that, you know, certain songs are going to work here and certain songs are just for touring and certain songs are particularly for an album, but I'm never going to sing them live. And it becomes an interesting sort of little package.
Yeah, it does. And I kind of think it's not how it should be, but it feels closer to the actual tradition of passing songs down orally. Is that, you know, you're thinking, how am I going to tell the story within a room full of people who are also singing with me, rather than stuck up on a stage sort of presenting something that's like prearranged. And it feels like actually that the songs that have been passed down and stayed with us are the ones that are just so good in exactly that situation. So they're the ones that you're drawn to singing. And so probably more traditional songs are coming into our repertoire as a result of doing more of that type of singing. It's a very welcome change at the moment.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I think it's great that you've got that sing around that you've set up in Bristol. Obviously, we talked about it in an article that we did on Tradfolk recently, but I'm very aware of the fact that we've got listeners who listen to this podcast who don't necessarily read what's on the Tradfolk website themselves, the fools. But I think it might be useful for you to tell us a little bit about where that session can be found and when it can be found and how people can get involved.
Sure. Well, the first thing to say, I'll let you talk about it if you want to, but I'll just say the first thing to say is to anyone listening who doesn't get on the Tradfolk website, get on there, because there's so much stuff. John, I don't know where you find the time to do all of this stuff. It is an incredible asset. Loads of very, very interesting articles and interviews with people. And yeah, we're certainly very grateful for you pulling that together. So anyone who hasn't got into it, get into it. But anyway,
that's
Sid,
very kind of you to say. And the answer to that question about where I find the time, I don't. I don't have a life anymore. I just, this is all I do. So.
We know where to find you. Okay. Yeah, the singing session, I think we were running it for a year and a half, maybe 2 years before the pandemic arrived. It's still going strong. I went to the last one and I hadn't been for a very long time before that because I've been working away, sadly. But I was so chuffed to arrive and I was able to just go to it rather than have to deliver it. It's a self-sustaining thing where people arrive and they just kick it off with a song and there's no rules. It just whoever fancies singing next sings next. And there's no pressure to sing, but everyone's welcome to sing, and it's a lovely environment. But it happens in the Star Pub in Fishponds. It doesn't have a regular date. There's a WhatsApp group that I think maybe 150 people are on now, and it's organised on there. There's also a Facebook group, the Star Singers Session, and usually if we're present enough, we will post when it's happening on there. Just so anyone who doesn't want to be on the WhatsApp and be spammed with folk stuff can come along.
The only other thing to add to that is, I guess what's unusual about it is that it is a very, very young session. A lot of the singing sessions that we end up in around the country are cross-generational, but, like, you know, let's be honest, like often quite old in terms of the people there. This one is, me and Sid are definitely the old farts at this session. And I'd say the majority are sort of probably in their 20s, and there is an amazing folk scene in Bristol, I think. People who have come to traditional music through lots of different routes, but it feels like lots of people are finding ways of sort of expressing their identity through these songs. And it's just the most amazing thing to sit there. I actually love it when someone comes and they sing a song, reading the lyrics off their iPhone, and just doing it in their way. Like, they've chosen the song for this reason, and it feels like this whole other generation of singers coming through who've probably got much bigger repertoires than we have now. And everyone is welcome though, and it is like totally cross-generational, and as Sid said, anything goes. There are no rules, but it's generally a very respectful place, and probably the best pub in Bristol as well. So you can get a good pint as well.
Interesting that you talk about the young generation. When we published the article about your 10th anniversary on the Tradfolk website, somebody got in touch and said there's another very young session going on. Obviously, all of these are cross-generational. Everybody's welcome. We're not trying to be ageist here. Yeah. But there's a session that seems to be attracting a younger crowd in South London, somewhere around Deptford. It is a place called the Matchstick Pie House, I believe. And it's a live music venue. And I'm afraid right now I don't have any other details to hand. But apparently there is a young session with quite a big crowd going on down there as well. And I will put any further details that I pick up, because I'm sure somebody's going to get in touch and tell me when that time is and where it is exactly and all of that kind of thing. And I'll put that on the web page that accompanies this podcast so people can find that as well. Mm-hmm. And it'd be really interesting to hear from anybody else, actually, anybody listening, if you know of sort of really good, vibrant sing-arounds that are going on around the country, let us know, because there's nothing quite like it, is there?
We'd love to know. Yeah, that'd be really great to know where to head when we're out and about. That would be brilliant.
I can feel a Tradfolk article in the making here. That would be wonderful. And then, you know, when you're travelling through, you just look it up on Tradfolk, you're like, okay, well, I need a session, and pop up. I mean, there are loads. Definitely don't want to give an impression that, you know, this thing happening in Bristol is unique in any way. There are loads of young musicians and singers in the folk scene at the moment, but it's just so wonderful when you're in the middle of that. It feels like Sheffield has got a really kicking scene at the moment.
Sheffield, Leeds. Chris Brain in Leeds is running a great club up there called the Hyde Park Folk Club. Which is getting a lot of sort of plaudits. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff out there and sort of up and coming, I think. Just to bring us back to the song itself, and also talking about sort of young and up and coming musicians, actually versions of this song, of the Brisk Lad, that I've heard recently that I've particularly liked have been one by a chap called Henry Parker. Do you know of him?
I don't know, Fred.
He's a guitarist and singer, and he performs in a sort of, I suppose, 70s slightly sort of Bert Jansch-y style way, and he does a version of this which is, well, you could only really describe it as a psychedelic freak out.
Brilliant.
And it starts off very kind of on the down low and then sort of builds up to this sort of, yeah, you can quite picture yourself on a moor with the sort of howling thunder and rain of sort of Hendrix type guitars going on around you.
Cool.
So he does a really interesting version. And then quite on the opposite side of that, equally great, but in a much more stripped down version, is a singer called Elspeth Ann. I don't know if you've come across her either.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
She's on the Welsh Borders. And she sings a version of this just to a singular drone. And there's some great videos out there of her doing it up on the moors. Again, right. I'll stick those on the page associated with this podcast.
My children will hew the skin from the ewe. We'll be in a place where there's none. When the constables do come, I will stand with my gun, swearing all that I have is my own brave voice. Swearing all that I have is my own.
Those are two that have really caught my ear, both in the space of the last year. So it seems to be a song that's coming around again, having a moment.
And I guess there are many poaching songs out there, aren't there? But like, what drove people into poaching? You know, I guess people being moved off the land that they felt that, or they had traditionally had customary rights to. They were able to hunt and to farm, and they were pushed off and effectively entrapped into, you know, either working for the man or poaching or moving into the city and becoming an industrial worker. And often I think where, like, I mean, I'm completely making this up, but when times of poaching probably were peaking was when it was economically very, very hard times. And if you think what we're going through at the moment and probably what we're going to face over the next sort of couple of winters, cost of living crisis, and people are really feeling the impacts of inflation and unemployment is going to be going up. And so as we go through these other sort of economic sort of trials in a modern times, it's like, this is exactly what our traditional song should be doing, is sending us messages, I guess, from the past of how people have lived with that. It's not necessarily how to deal with it and how to fight back against it. It's just like, these are our experiences from the working people's history of this country. And so I guess, like, when times are hard, people do sort of gravitate towards these songs. I am speculating hard here, and people might have just, you know, decided to sing this song because they heard a lovely version of it on YouTube. But I think there is something in that, that, you know, you reach for the songs that reflect probably something about your experience today and how that's paralleled in our traditional song.
It's got a banging melody as well.
Oh, it's a banging melody, yeah. It really is.
I'm really looking forward to hearing what the two of you are going to do with it at the end of this podcast.
We didn't feel it was dark enough, so we'd made it even darker. This very bleak and defiant song. But yeah, it's a powerful old melody. All of the different versions, you know, every singer has kind of got their take on it, but it's one that lends itself to quite a punchy delivery, I think.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time, gents.
It's a pleasure.
And I'm really hoping to get out and see you on the tour.
That'd be nice. Yeah.
Please do. Yeah, there's loads of information up online about it all. And yeah, we'd love to see people. We haven't been gigging as much as we normally would. That's partly due to the pandemic, obviously, but it's also just we have different things going on now as well, different acts that we're involved in and different bits of work. And so, you know, we're heading out a little bit tentatively. Are people going to come out? Have they forgotten who we are? And so, yeah, if people are hearing this, we'd absolutely love to see you. And we don't know when the next sort of duo tour will be, hopefully sort of later next year, but we'll have to see. So yeah, it'd be great to see people out and about. And John, it'd be so nice to see you at one of the gigs or to bump into you. We'll have to get along to another singer session as soon as we can.
Excellent. You certainly will.
Great to see you.
Thanks so much.
And to build a house down on the
Huge thanks there to Jimmy and Sid for their time and their knowledge. And thanks also to Peter at the English Folk Dance and Song Society and to Alex, the librarian at the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library as well. In the next episode, we're going to have Angeline Morrison chatting about one of the most beautiful and tragic songs that I know, Shallow Brown. So until then, here's Jimmy and Sid to sing you out with their unaccompanied version of The Brisk Lad.
I am a brisk lad whose fortune is bad, and I am misfortunate poor. Indeed, I intend my fortune to mend, and to build a house down on the moor, my brave boys. Yes, to build a house down on the moor. My father does keep fat oxen and sheep on a neat little neck of the downs, and in the middle of the night, when the moon does shine bright, there's a great deal of work to be done, my brave boys. Yes, there's a great deal of work to be done. I'll walk all around in another man's ground, And I'll take a fat sheep for my own, and with the aid of my knife I will end of its life. And then I will carry it home, my brave boys. And then I will carry it home. My children will pull the skin from the wool, and I will be weathering on. And when the constables do come, I will stand with my gun, and I'll swear all I have is my own, my brave boys. Yes, I'll swear all I have is my own. I am a brisk lad whose fortune is bad, and I am misfortunate poor. Indeed, I intend my fortune to mend, and to build a house down on the moor, my brave boys. Yes, to build a house down on the moor.